Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za. Point of view.
Legal matters. Okay, it's Wednesday, so Ntabiseng is here. Hello, Ntabiseng, and welcome.
Good evening. Nice to be back. How are you?
Yo. That story is heavy. That story is so heavy. But we're good for having you here today. And we're going to talk about inequality. You know, it's very rare for people to sometimes move the spotlight and face it right back at yourself and say, we too as lawyers have problems.
Yes.
What are some of the issues you wanted to highlight?
So we are in a situation whereby the Legal Sector Council has put in a bill that is supposed to equalize us as attorneys in the legal fraternity.
What does that mean?
So our fraternity is predominantly white dominated.
Male.
White too. Male, to be specific. Mm. And to penetrate it is very difficult. Mm. As a woman in general, but mostly as a black woman. Mm. So the LSC has tried to try and mitigate this situation. Mm. And in so doing, they request that, for example, law firms that have a turnover of a certain amount between 3 to 5 million, they don't have to comply with certain requirements or scoreboards, wherein if in that 3 to 5 million turnaround or turnover, you have a quota of between 51% black partners or directors within that law firm. And then those who are above that, they have to comply with it. There's a scorecard that needs to be followed. So what they're trying to do is to ensure that both the private and the public sector look at law firms that are black owned, or look at counsel, which is advocates that are black, who can be given instructions, which is what we struggle with. So the sectors that are very hard to break in will be commercial law firms. Commercial law actually is just predominantly white. You will really, really find black owned, and black goes not just from African descent, as you know, it will be colored and Indian people as well. So these law firms struggle.
I think Chinese also.
Yes, you're correct. So they struggle to get instructions. And when they do, they cannot brief any other counsel. White counsel is usually the one that's briefed. And when you go to all these high courts, most of the time when you appear there, you're one of the minorities that are going to appear in the high court. But go to Match Court, you will find you'll only find black practitioners there. Yes. Domestic violence, divorce, some Match Court, criminal law. Yes. So these are the things that the LSC is trying to mitigate. And by so doing, they are also saying that they are going to allow loans or be able to give law firms that are black owned, and over 50% of that black ownership, 25%, I beg your pardon, has to be black female, wherein they should be recognized in one form or another. So with all of this that we are dealing with and we're being challenged with, and mind you, this also comes on the back of the other case that I'm going to talk about that I was involved in late last year. We have white practitioners who go up against you in court, and when they do so, and the presiding officer is black, they speak with such disdain to not only us as practitioners.
You know, funny enough, I saw your post around the attitude.
Yes.
And in fact, I think subsequent to that, I saw three more.
Yeah.
And one of the lawyers was posting, I'm so close to exposing this particular law firm because the disdain and the disrespect is, and also a young female, black female, who was like, you know, you just have to stop.
Yes.
People just need to stop. So what exactly goes on there?
It starts with the non-cogealness. And whenever somebody comes to me for a divorce, for whatever the case may be, the first thing that we do is to try and open communication with the other side. I always think Mm. And that is the operative word. We always think that if there's an attorney on the other side, it makes things easier.
Because you understand, you're all just professionals at the end of the day.
But what you tend to find is that...
It's a real fight.
It's a real, real fight. Mm. And especially if you're dealing with somebody who is white. Mm. And they undermine you at every turn. They talk down to you. In fact, the emails are so downright, who are you? Who are you speaking to when they speak to you?
Mm.
I have had to reply to so many emails whereby my opponents are white practitioners. Mm. And they are talking down to me like I don't know the law.
Mm.
And what they are talking about in their papers or even in their normal correspondence has nothing to do with the law. And I'm the one who's correcting them.
Mm.
And they can't come back to say, oh, I apologize. I did not realize, one, that I was incorrect. Two, that I spoke down to you. And I make sure I articulate everything that you have said in your email to show you the kind of disrespect that you are directing my way.
Mm.
What was said about this particular one in December for me was that it was also a female.
Mm.
Old woman, probably in her 60s now. And the way in which when I spoke to the judge, it was in the high court, when I was addressing the judge, she would interject at every two sentences. And eventually I looked at the presiding officer and I'm like, my lord, are you going to address my colleague?
Mm.
Because she's not allowing me to proceed.
Mm.
The judge was a black man.
Mm.
The look that he gave me the impression, you know, I remember this video that I saw, that it's a comedy thing, that the black conversation through the eyes.
Mm.
Yes. The look he gave me is like, relax, calm down.
Mm.
So I did that. He didn't respond. He just kept quiet. He didn't say anything. He just gave me a look, relax and calm down.
Mm.
So I calmed down. And when I calmed down, I then, okay, my lord, let me address you the way that she wants me to address you.
Mm.
And then that's when she sat down and I addressed. And when she responded, she had really nothing to challenge. And then the court asked me, do you have anything to reply? I replied with two sentences and that's that. And then he said he's going to pen his judgment. He will give it whenever he's ready.
Mm.
Not a problem. The attorney after that was an Indian lady.
Mm.
The way she spoke to the presiding officer, even the judge asked, ma'am, are you addressing me?
Mm.
Speaking like that.
Mm.
When did you hear me say the words that you're saying?
Mm.
And she couldn't respond. I don't know where that matter ended because I ended up leaving because mine was done and dusted.
Mm.
But these are the things that we see in the high court.
Mm.
And this is the place where you think that decorum and ethics are a little bit more pronounced.
The thing, though, is that no amount of legislation is going to deal with that.
Yes.
And therefore, so what's the attitude, amongst colleagues with regards to this legislation that's being proposed?
So, obviously, for a lot of black-owned law firms and a lot of black counsel, it is some sort of reprieve to say maybe there's hope.
Mm.
There's a chance for us to actually make a real business out of running a law firm.
Mm.
Because most law firms that are black are working from hand to mouth.
Yeah.
Because if you happen to want to be on a panel of attorneys for government...
And I'm going to get there. Because isn't that just part of the problem?
Yes.
Government itself does not brief black lawyers.
That's correct.
Or counsel.
For example, we have been sitting on a board of attorneys for... I even forget what that is. We only got to do one. We're supposed to be there for 3 years. They've only given us instructions once worth 19,000 rand.
Wow.
They have not returned since then.
Wow.
That is what we are up against.
And they brief them for millions.
Yes. And ours was 450,000 spread over 3 years.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
And when you pitch yourself as a law firm, black owned, BEE,
with all the things that they say they
and
want,
and you're a female and all of that,
means nothing.
You still have to bring down your fees because you know that the top five law firms, they'll bring it lower so that they can get to the business.
Yeah.
You can't afford to bring it lower than a certain point, because you were not going to make ends meet. You have overheads and you cannot meet that. And well, that goes both for the public and the private sector. And now we have Norton Rose that has taken the matter to court to say the legal sector council code is not going to work. It's unattainable.
Oh,
it's
wow.
unconstitutional.
Oh.
Nothing can be met.
Oh.
I only got up to page 54 of their founding affidavit. It's 109 pages.
So she was already sweating. She couldn't take it anymore. she was so angry. She just thought, no, I can't do this. I'll have to come back again.
And of the
So Norton Rose is opposing this proposal.
Yes. They're saying that it should be reviewed. It cannot be done. It's unconstitutional for that matter. It doesn't meet the normal criteria of the triple BEE. It doesn't meet this. It doesn't meet that. And Ibile Bona as Norton Rose, when they look at what the scorecard for certain companies that earn 25 million and above, they already are falling short of what the legal sector code wants. Now, what they're stated in their papers is like, over and above that, last year, 2023, we're in 2025 now, so 2023, they onboarded a black, 100% black female owned law firm, whereby they are subsidizing her for this, that, and the other. That in itself should be something that should be considered. The practitioner at some stage lost her laptop. They repaid, they paid for her to get a laptop.
Oh, wow.
Now this year she's in a position to get a candidate attorney.
Oh, she's so, because she must of be their so assistance. Grateful.
And then over and above that, they gave her a license for LexisNexis. This is our bookstore. As attorneys and all of that, so she can get access to those. I did that on my own. I did not need all of that. And I come from a situation whereby when we opened the firm, when I left my employment, I only had 50,000 rand. And I still have all of those things that they have done for this particular on my own. And then over and above that, they're saying that they support children shelters.
Hey,
that should be considered as well, because again, in Africa, children shelters are black kids at the end of the day that are struggling, not white kids. And that, these are the part of the things that they're listing that should be considered when these scorecards for this unattainable reality of black persons going to that kind of level.
While they get briefed.
Yes.
Because I can tell you now, government still briefs them.
Correct.
As well as other companies where they have relations.
It is it is such a... It is sad. And usually these things, we talk about them as black practitioners in our little corners. It's never brought out in any manner. We complain about it in our little platforms, on our WhatsApp groups maybe, or one-on-ones, or after you had a fight with the presiding officer, whatever the case may be. And it's never actually brought to the forefront that this is the situation. This case is now showing just how bad it is in the legal fraternity. It is not easy. And then when you appear there as a woman, already they assume you don't know what the law is. And everybody talks down at you until you quote the law. So you have to not only prove yourself, but you have to go there uber prepared. You cannot go and mess up there, because they make an example of you, all these presiding officers.
So since Norton Rose has responded to this, what do you think is likely to happen?
So I don't know if there's a answering affidavit to their founding as yet, but if there is, because they have cited the LPC, for example, in there, they have cited all these.
Has the Black Lawyers Association, you know, are you guys also organizing, in as much as they are so busy, you know, putting their own affidavit forward?
I don't know if the BLA is going to be involved in this, for example, or what is this? The advocates, that Pabasa, I think it is.
Oh, Pabasa, yes.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if they're going to be involved in this kind of litigation. We hope that they will. So we have someone who's fighting against this, but they're not cited. But I want them, I would like for them to join as interested parties, because that's going to affect us all. So it is something that I saw and I thought, you know what,
it's tough everywhere.
It's very tough.
It's tough everywhere.
Yeah.
Yo. All right. Let's talk about I mean, like, it sounds like today's show is so depressing. Interim maintenance on a disputed customary marriage.
Yes.
So this is maintenance on this partner. For the other partner.
Yes.
Not for children.
Okay? Yes. So it's the very same opponent that I'm talking about. So we initiated a divorce. And we contacted the husband directly because we are the plaintiffs. And the request was, let's have a round table, as always, to see if we can amicably resolve this, get this done as soon as possible. And then he's like, no, I'll get back to you. When he eventually got back to us was through attorneys. And their first letter was, you are being ridiculous. What do you mean? There's no such thing as a customary marriage under these circumstances. And then, okay, we proceeded with the matter. It got dragged for a little bit. And then our client says, I'm not employed. I need funds to survive. I've been relying on this man for over 18 years. So we then applied for a Rule 43, which is the interim maintenance that I speak of. And then because unfortunately the courts had issues with dates, it took quite some time. And then we were heard in December last year. So in our a Rule 43, yes, ma'am.
So she needed interim maintenance while this
divorce
matter
is proceeding. So in a Rule 43 application, you need to play open cards with the court. You need to give your financial disclosure affidavit, give everything
you've
told to
the us court. That, yes.
But they did not. Up until the matter was set
down. They just said, we're not doing it.
That's
we don't
correct.
Have, he doesn't have the, did they even say he doesn't have the
they
money?
Just said,
he's not going to do it.
Yeah, we're not going to do it. And
we're not
also,
paying maintenance.
Yes. And also this marriage doesn't exist anyway, so why are we even here? That was the gist of their argument.
So was it a civil marriage?
No, customary.
Okay.
So when the matter was eventually heard, obviously they, me being overprepared, knowing the circumstances, researching on case law, putting it there that even if the marriage is being disputed, interim maintenance can still be paid. Having financial disclosures there and all of that. And then my opponent just said, well, the funny thing is that in her reply to my argument is saying that on the date of the marriage.
Oh, okay. Now it's a marriage.
Yes. Okay. And then the court made her repeat it three times. Then, are you saying there is a marriage? Yes. When was this marriage conducted? On the day Lobola was paid. Are you sure, man? That's what you're saying.
Because it's countering your own argument.
Yes. Yeah. And then she wanted to say that it is not possible that on the date that Mahari or Lobola is paid cannot be deemed to be the date of marriage. So when we responded to that, we're saying, but it's the same thing as saying that you go in a civil marriage, you go to Home Affairs and you go sign, and then you decide to have a wedding day 10 days later.
The civil signature is
the date.
Date
of marriage.
Yeah.
And then that's when the court said, you know what, I'm going to reserve my judgment. I will let you guys know once I'm ready. I will send you the judgment. Judgment came out on the 6th of this year. And the gist of that entire judgment was the respondent, which is the husband, and through his attorney, had nothing else to say except the applicant is crazy. Saying there's no marriage.
She's mad. I'm not giving her the money.
Yes. And yet he is not playing open cards to show us his status. So I have nothing to work on to try and see his point of view. So we only have the wife's side of the story. So as a result, as the attorney for the applicant has shown, there's numerous case law that shows that interim maintenance can be paid even though a marriage is being disputed.
Yeah.
And as such, what we requested, we got. So 10 days from the 6th, she's supposed to start getting money that is due to her per the judgment. So the main reason, apart from the Norton Rose situation, is that we always say, I thought it was just an engagement, okay, but it's, and then we never lived together, or I'm disputing customary marriage, and as a result, I'm not liable for X, Y, and Z. Please note that you are.
And you go ahead and buy the engagement ring.
Yeah.
And then dispute it afterwards.
Exactly.
If he does not pay, what then happens?
It will be a contempt of court. Because if
and then he may end up in jail.
Correct. Because even though there's a main proceeding, which is the
still
divorce,
coming. Yes.
This is already a decision. It's an interlocutory decision of the main.
Yes.
And it must be adhered to.
Yeah. So while we wait for the finalization of the divorce itself.
Yes.
He still needs to pay in the interim.
Correct. Correct. So, and if he doesn't, contempt of court, and then he'll be liable to pay whatever he's failed to pay in the past, however many months or days or whatever. And then further to that, it can be a situation where he may find himself behind bars.
Yo, wow. I mean, that's quite telling. Because, yeah. And so this is interesting. Where the case is right now, with this part of the case being where it is right now, yeah. would there still be room for, I think, mediation?
Yes, Rule 41 can still be followed, because now if the court is saying, the court in this particular instance cannot, or its job was not to decide on the validity yes. of the marriage.
Got you.
So as a result, we can still go back to the drawing board.
And still mediate.
Yes.
And not fight for that. For the divorce to either proceed or not proceed, yes, either side.
Yes. So what we can say that, okay, we agree that there's a letter Yamahadi. It's mm. there. It's not disputed.
We agree that we need to pay the interim maintenance yes. while we're fighting over whether we're making up or still fighting.
You see? Mm-hmm. And then we agree that there are kids born of this marriage. And we agree that...
Oh, are they children
there's
too?
Children.
Oh, that so, is very interesting.
So this money is not only for
Hang
the
on.
Spouse.
Hang on.
Yeah.
So in this case, was it maintenance for her or for the children
Both.
Too?
It was for both.
Hmm.
It was for both. And they were arguing that, well, we like she says, she depends on us anyway. So we're still going to take care of the kid. It's her, the kid without having to take care of her.
Hmm.
But in our papers, in our financial disclosure, we can prove that he is not taking care of the minor in any event. She has to always try and get money out of him. So she's been trying to sell this and that just to make ends meet. And then with that, they can't disprove it because they didn't give us their financial disclosure. So you are just expecting the court to accept your argument by word of mouth without you proving anything on paper.
And all the other obligations, school issues and stuff, he was also not carrying those out.
Yes, yes.
Huh. So would you then have been forced to also go to the maintenance court or the is it the family court?
It would have been the maintenance court
yes.
for him to pay. But since we're in the middle of a divorce, it's easier to deal with that in the divorce instead of having two different
yes.
applications
yeah.
in two different courts.
Mm.
And one other argument that they were trying to raise is that the youngest kid is 17. He'll be turning 18 sometime later
so
this year.
We're about to come
That's
out of
what
this problem.
Saying.
We're about to come out of this problem.
So it's, why are we no longer even here?
Yeah.
So, and remember, we spoke of a case sometime last year that was recently decided, where in a divorce proceeding, the mom was requesting for maintenance for her adult children.
Because they're not working.
Correct. They were still in varsity. And then the father opposed and said, no, if anything, they should bring their own application, not mom. And then the court said, no, in terms of the Divorce Act, she's entitled to do so. And as a result, she will get maintenance ordered in this divorce decree. So that argument is also going to fall away.
Wow. I mean, listen, the lines are open, 086-000-0959, and the voice note is on 063-688-0959. So the moral of the story here is that if he had separated the children and the spouse, would it have been easier?
No.
No. Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, we are still arguing that there's a marriage, and of the marriage,
yes,
children
you.
Were born. So you can't separate the two.
Hmm.
Once a divorce decree has been granted, that's a different story completely. He can argue that I want to just maintain the kids. In fact, in our argument, we were actually saying the request of X amount, it can be reduced because since the date of making the application, we have since been given instruction that our client got a part-time job.
Oh.
She's earning X amount of money.
Hmm.
So you can reduce it to whatever that makes you comfortable.
Things like living arrangements,
yes.
I'm supposing he's also responsible for that
yeah.
or was responsible
was.
For that.
Yeah.
Had he attempted to change any of that, in other words, maybe sell the property, or what was his... application.
He had stopped paying
the services. Services, yeah.
Yes. So they were now just going sky high. And you know they can sell the property to
yes,
recoup.
To, yes,
they so
can.
Those are part and parcel of the things that need to be paid with this interim maintenance.
La Sueña.
Yay.
No, I know, Latsvinya, eh? You know, after all that, after all that, and then you just want to be difficult. So if everything goes according to how we think it's going to go, because now we're probably going to acknowledge the fact that this was a marriage in the first place.
Yes.
She's probably entitled to 50% of everything he has.
Correct.
Even the stuff that he doesn't want to disclose.
Yes. And that's the problem where in the financial disclosure, maybe that's why they didn't want to give it, because the financial disclosure gives information that is hidden, because we want all your bank accounts, everything. So it's going to show that you were transferring from Tabisin to Pemir to try and hide funds.
Paying not in rules.
You are.
let's take a voice note.
Yeah, my sister, she's right. You know, with this white firms, law firms, they are very corrupt. And then especially when also comes to these things of housing, like maybe your bond, etc., etc., you will find they find ways, you know, to especially when you're about to finish, you'll find ways to push you if maybe there's a little error, maybe areas, you know, and then, you know, and they will send you all those documents and to claim that they will be consulting you, they will be phoning you, and you are never answering their calls, and then they will be trying all those things. You know, all those things, you know, these people, you know, actually, you don't speak about white-collar crime. I like also that lady which you are with there to speak about the banks itself, because it's also involved, they are also involved in commercial law firms that are also involved, so to speak. Because there's one thing which I want to raise, for instance, just hear me out on this one. When you open an account in a bank, the bank, you are the client of the bank, and the bank, it's to protect you, isn't it? And your account. So if you come to a bank and say, hey, you are my worker, I'm your boss, please get rid of this account. I don't want this person to come and into my account and do whatever he please. No way to ask whether you've done something before, you've signed some agreement with you. It's his responsibility to go and take you to court or small claim court. They don't have the right to come and tell you that, no, you have signed this agreement, we can't. You have to call those person to close that account. No, that doesn't work. That is a white-collar crime itself. There's a lot of white-collar crime that's happening under our nose. And then we keep on, and then it's like it's normal. It is totally wrong.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, everybody understands the discrimination.
Yes. And it's unfortunately, it is what is the term that they use when it's in plain sight, but it's kind of hidden?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that kind of discrimination that we deal with. And what he talks about when it comes to property, I think we said this sometime, not last year, late 2022, when Mitzi was here, saying that when you are buying property, you're always referred to a specific law firm.
It's already chosen for you.
Yes, for you to choose this particular conveyancer. And you're not bound to use anyone's conveyance. You can pick your own conveyancer.
No. And that's not the impression they give you.
No.
The bank already tells you, here's firm X who will be handling your matter.
Yes.
Let's go to a call. Pure is in Johannesburg. Hello, good evening and welcome.
Hi, how are you, Ntamsen? How are you doing?
Hi.
Good evening.
I'm okay, man. Look, man, I want to contribute on the issue of the conduct of white lawyers. I'm actually in the legal press, but I'm not an attorney.
Yes, sir.
And your speaker, I just forgot her name, your speaker is very correct. But what is then happening, that problem is also at the CCMA level, because I'm always at the CCMA level.
Mm.
You found commissioners, particularly white commissioners, will treat you as an African person, as a black person, and the way they speak to you, the way they're tone towards you, as a child of a lesser god. In fact, I even said to one commissioner,
I like how you put it.
They speak to you as a child of a lesser god, and when a colleague is white, they will speak to their colleague with respect. In fact, I had an objection in one matter that I've just done now with one commissioner, and I read it twice. And at first he came in and said, "Look, When I read that objection, I said to him, no, Commissioner, you're not going to give me that look. You're not going to treat me like a child that's a lesser god.
Mm.
You understand? So it does happen a number of times. And fortunately, the colleague that I was dealing with, those was a white lady, but that woman is a very professional lady. And in fact, she just kept quiet because, and I could see she was shocked. But I'm just saying, you do find that. But look, I'm going to stretch it a bit. Just a little bit, please. Mm. I know that we're talking about legal issues.
No, that's okay.
But this thing talks to the ruling party for them to allow these white people to even undermine us when we're in government. Because it is this, let's leave this thing of JNU now. All along, there's been the African National Congress that was in government. They never briefed black lawyers.
This is what we were saying, that we don't have government briefing black lawyers.
Yes.
Yeah, even now, those that are briefed, and I have respect for Chandalai Ngubi, Chambai Togalai Ngubi, that person is brilliant. But you would find that for you to get work in a government area, either you must be a collaborator or a worshipper of those white people. So you must be the what I call the special black.
Mm.
You know, not the special black. If you're not black and you don't have friends, you have no connections, don't get these things. You know, even those ones that they are printing now, they are printing them now. Now, if you look at what, even those that today that claims in the other party, the MK, they claim that, look, Tine want black people, but go look at
who's briefing. Who is
he briefing? It's even white people later. They don't brief. The government doesn't brief black people unless Africans begin to club together and fight and say, look, you either come out as government and be honest and say, look, we have no confidence in you African people. We have no confidence in you black people. We're not going to brief you. But don't pretend as if you are for us and don't brief us. That is a very big problem. But like I'm saying in closing, As much as I get irritated, but the very people that you must blame is the government. The government has set the tone everywhere.
Yeah.
They've set the tone everywhere.
No, you are spot on. I mean, this was something that has been raised even publicly.
Yes.
Thank you so much for that. And I remember the case, Marikana, actually.
Mm.
You remember when, I think it was Advocate Dumisa Ntsebeza.
Yes.
Who asked the president at the time, was he deputy president?
It was deputy, at the time.
It was Cyril Ramaphosa, yes. And said, you know, Just look at your legal team.
Mm.
Just and he was a transformation. I don't know, chairperson in Lonmin at the time, and he brought the point to say, but
look what's happening.
Transformation chairman. You know, and look at your legal team.
Yes.
And that was public. So I'm speaking of something that happened publicly. It's not a rumor.
I recall a client that wanted to take on our services and they wanted us to audition. And by audition, I mean they asked, please send me at least 3 or 4 cases that you have won.
Mm.
And then so that I can look through and see if you are worth the money that you are charging.
Mm.
And that person had come to us to complain that they've already paid a white law firm over 500,000 and they haven't gotten the results that they wished.
Mm.
And they were complaining of a deposit at less than 20,000 rand.
Oh, wow. Let's take a listen to a voice note.
I wanted to inquire. I happen to be in an advocacy for Community Development Trust.
Mm-hmm.
That Community Development Trust, a heritage site, as well as a tourist attraction. For the past 25 years plus, I've been advocating for resettlement since Gwilegwa issue was restitution ya hona. Now, who will form more? That's the point of my inquiry. For me, since that farm now, nearly my grandmother, who said my mama fela. And then Nakinali siblings, they four. So I was the only one who's following up ka advocacy. Now, for me, it's with Ebata co-signatories, which are my siblings. Yes. The other two siblings, Abasutsibi, Wabai too, I approached them. So I could see the red flag I approached her 2 years because Hangashwa, which means the land is going to be lost. And the other catch I on land, you cannot sell it once it's given to you. The other thing, Gore, utoy forfeit if ever you submit false information, like not declaring Gore on a lady siblings. So, car problem basically. Which is me, in Alimatata. Now I'm asking legally, if ever, retrovali meeting finalize entry, but I'm just, you know, in a cautionary mood. If ever, you know, ring or opposer, or maybe ba opposing our fella, which can happen. What is legally nga defend avian?
Okay, so it sounds like it's a deceased estate more than anything else. Yes, ki heritage land.
Yeah, Mari, he mustn't hide things.
No, it's going to. It'll mudriba.
You already know that.
Yes. Mm. So, from what I can gather, mom is still alive. And if mom is still alive, she is the direct descendant of the deceased, who is Gogo Wantati, who's giving us the voice note.
Yeah.
Now, with that being said, he must make sure that the co-signatories, which are the siblings, it's what we call a redistribution agreement in a manner of speaking. And in that redistribution, if they want to forfeit the land, fine. If they want it to be divided in whatever, but it has to be set down and written by all parties and it is agreed.
Marekare, I think it sounds deeper. In the sense, they just want to oppose.
Yes.
They don't want him to have this land,
which is still fine.
Yeah.
What can be done is that it can be a title deed can have up to 30 people, so that title deed can be under all of their names, and then Gogo, which is their mother, can have what we call a usufruct attached to that particular land. In other words, it cannot be sold. No,
I think it's already there. Yes.
So if they can do that, then it's easy. What they need to do, just get an attorney to explain the legalities of this form. Mm. So that when it goes back, because if they if he didn't tell them and then they find out,
then it's also
then
going
he's
to
going
problem.
To lose it anyway. According to the form.
Yeah.
So let them just sit down with an attorney so they can explain how this is going to work once this thing goes forward.
Yeah, I think there are bigger problems.
Yeah, no, there are.
I think there's conflict. Sbu in Tefontaine, hi.
Hello, Liz. How are you?
We're good.
Isn't that saying?
Hi.
Kentani, Sistemelo. sorry,
yes,
I had a flashback. happy 2025.
Happy. To you too.
Please, help me here with with the bloodlines that I'm experiencing.
Yes.
Something that's very much on current affairs at the moment,
mm-hmm.
Which is the right to life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Versus the law being broken in your territory.
Mm.
I'm sure it rings a bell.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to understand is the law, based on the Constitution, are you obligated? This is my understanding, and this is what I want to confirm. Are you obligated to uphold the right to life of a person in your territory who is in danger? And we can, obviously, this is a multifaceted matter, right?
Yes.
But for some of the people involved, we can say they put themselves in that position. But the other angle is that some were coerced or didn't know what situation they would find themselves in. But I don't know if they didn't know going underground that what situation there would be, or they knew but they didn't know to what extent, right? So the clarification that I need is, Is it correct? Is my understanding correct that the law, based on the Constitution, stipulates that you must uphold the right to life by any means necessary, meaning even if it's going to financially cost you, and then face the criminality element of it afterwards, then that comes secondary.
Okay. So the right to life, the way it came about was as a result of the S versus Makwanyane case, ne? Where he was sentenced to death. And it was during the interim constitution at the time. So the way in which the right to life was preserved was because of the way in which the apartheid laws were operating when it came to certain things, and especially in how investigations were conducted and in how in the past black people were just sentenced to death without a fair trial. So that is the context in which our right to life came to life. Ne? Now, with that being said, our constitution has section 36, which is the limitations of rights, right? So even though the right to life is absolute, no one should be put to death by another person or by government. It doesn't mean that if somebody puts themselves in harm, that in harm's way, sorry, then we should now also put ourselves in harm's way in order to prevent that person from dying. That is not my understanding and interpretation of the Constitution, and especially when it comes to the right of life. So the issues that are being raised in this particular situation that we are seeing in the headlines, people having placed themselves in that particular sector, one, in an illegal form by by contravening Section 49 of the Immigration Act, which is being illegal in the country. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is conducting things that are not supposed to be done in a place illegal activities. Those are already crimes on their own. So now, having gone underground or whatever the case may be, us trying to remove them from that situation where they are putting themselves in harm means that we also have to put ourselves in harm. So whose life is...
So this explains then the decision to, yes, have a crane, but no official of the state is actually going down. Hence, you have the volunteers from the community saying, no, we will go down and look. Nobody from the operation and the state is sending anybody down.
The crane is being hired, isn't it? So
from a company.
There's financial implications involved.
But isn't it being hired by the volunteers?
No. Oh, okay. So there's two different things. There is the right to life, as in life, the body. So let's separate the issues a little bit, Spoo. There's the body, and then there's the money and the state's funds. That's two different things. So the state fund is funding the technical process of getting...
Is it obligated?
No, that's not what I'm saying. We're talking about the right to life. So that's those are very different arguments. Even when you go to court, you're going to argue different things. So the right to life is one, which is one thing. So in this case, the paramedics and all the people that are in this project and in this operation are not going down, putting their bodies on the line to assist those who've got a right to life. Do you understand that? So that's the right to life argument. So they're not sending anybody down. The people who are going down are volunteers who are saying, I'm putting my life on the line as a family member, as a community member, and so on. It's not the state's people.
That's correct, yeah.
Because the state has a responsibility to look after the bodies of paramedics and so on.
Yes.
The issues around spending of the money, that's a separate issue. It's not about the right to preserve other people's lives and weighing up whose life is more important. That's a separate, completely different argument.
Yeah, because now I think part of the arguments that I've heard being raised is that, yes, they're suffering down there, they don't have food and whatnot, the humanity.
Yeah, because that's also a separate argument.
Separate argument.
Feeding them and all of that is not about other putting other people in danger.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there is no obligation on our legal sector or sphere to provide these people with their right to life, if that makes any sense. They put themselves in that predicament, and with no one forcing them, at least that's what we gather.
So, but they've gone to court twice.
Yes.
And the court has ruled that they be fed.
Yes. Yeah. And with that, it is an obligation that here's the food, how you get it. We're not going to go down there for you to be fed.
Yeah.
But here's the food. How you decide to come and get it is a problem. And now when they come out to come and get it, they know they're going to be arrested for all these other crimes. Mm-hmm. So now they remain down there where they are inaccessible. And now they keep dying there. So now it's as if.
I think the chronological order is also very important. Mm. So before the court ordered that the police and government should feed them.
Mm.
There was another process before
Correct.
That. So there had to be a process and government acknowledging that, yes, we are going to rescue. I suspect in those papers, there was an acknowledgement that the government has neglected its duties, which is why government is now responsible for securing that space.
Yes.
So I think there's a whole long process before we get to the point where government now must feed them.
Mm.
So there's an acknowledgement of other responsibilities that government had and its own responsibilities that it didn't, it negated.
It negated
those responsibilities. So it's not, you know, you don't start with the case at the end.
In the middle,
you've got to kind of go all the way back and how the judge gets to the point where they say, well, actually, it is still government's responsibility because we partly are here because of other responsibilities that were neglected.
But for you not leaving the mine exposed
Correct.
Or vulnerable,
Absolutely.
We would not find here. Ourselves here.
Correct.
Yeah.
Let's take a voice note.
Good evening, I was in Tabitha, I was Pimelo. This is Mavatu. I just want to find out a quick one. My mother-in-law passed away and left the house in our names, like all her children, four of them and their spouse. Now my sister-in-law doesn't have a house. She can't stay in the house. They're fighting for the house, the kids. Now she registered for an RDP. They told her she's on the permit of that house, so she can't get an RDP and she really needs a house. How do we deal with this? How does she get out of the permit? What can we do? Because now the RDP was supposed to be handed to her 2023, but because of the name of her name on the permit doesn't allow her to have two names on two permits. How do we deal with it so that she gets that RDP?
Okay, so let's sign a redistribution agreement. So it'd be an agreement between the siblings and their spouses that they are quote unquote buying her out of her portion.
Mm.
And then we approach D's office and then she's removed. So if there's 10 of you guys and the house costs 100,000, then you're going to pay her out her portion, which is 10,000 rand in the redistribution agreement.
Or you can or you whatever. Make an offer?
You can make an offer.
Can you agree on a rand?
Yeah.
Okay.
And say this
no,
is
I'm
what
not
we're
joking.
Agreeing on.
I'm being serious.
Yes. No,
so
really.
the value of her 10% could be equal to one rand.
Yes.
But it's a transaction, if you understand what I mean.
And then her name will be removed, and then you take that redistribution agreement, and then you take it to the deeds office, the deeds office, and then the deeds office, by virtue of that, will remove her from that, and then she can start her process of applying.
And again, I'm being quite serious about this. So a transaction can be anything you agree to.
That's correct.
But the point is that it's a transaction, even if it's 10 rand, but you guys agree that for her portion, we are giving her 10 rand. She agrees. She walks away. Unka tanranda hai, and then she can then proceed
That's
with
correct.
The other property.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Is there another voice note? Okay. So the Spoo, I think we lost Spoo there a little bit. This you were still explaining how some of the other responsibilities that government have, like spending on this whole operation.
Yeah.
I think, and I could be wrong here because we're all speculating. If you will remember, one of the ministers said part of what is going to have to be ironed out by government is amongst themselves who's actually going to take responsibility, even with the budget to do this. And I suspect one of the reasons that was going to be an issue is that there had to be a real justification.
Mm.
on the spending by which department.
Yes.
Because that matters, actually. Mm. Even when things go to court, by which department, yes, and how you justify which department was trying to achieve what.
Yeah.
So, was the purpose of the operation security? Was the purpose of the operation, protecting life? Was the purpose of the operation, because remember, and this was clarified by even our reporter earlier, there is Operation Shanela, there's Operation Valumkoti. Very important, because Operation Shanela is an ongoing operation by the police that is happening everywhere. And Operation Shanela does not only, if I can just put my thinking caps on, I don't think it relates only to mining. It's an operation that deals with criminality in general.
Yeah.
So if we've got a problem here at Kaya House and we have criminals who've invaded the space, we can call them and they will call it part of Operation Shanela.
Yeah.
They are going to weed out criminality. Mm. So the police, I think, can justify spending on Operation Shanela.
Yeah.
I think part of the reason this did not, or I think is not coming out of DMRE, is exactly that, the responsibility part.
Mm.
What are you calling this? If you are using, if it's money from DMRE, what is this?
What is it exactly?
What is it?
Yeah.
Because I think it has implications legally in the long run about a case which I think is looming, the human rights lawyer's case.
Yes.
And the issue of who are spending what money for what.
Yeah. Mm. And I think if memory serves, there was maybe in the first court case, I could be wrong, or it was just something that was in the media, wherein when these mines were shut down and they were no longer operating, there was money left over by the mining offices to deal with the, making sure that it's shut down.
It's
what happened to
Absolutely. And that I think is part of, when you come to the decision on who's spending what for what, it is almost part of the admissions of where things went wrong.
Correct.
And that's where the nub of the issue is going to come in.
I think that's why the court ruling that they must be fed came into being, because the admission of guilt part, that we failed in our mandate that was left to do X, Y, and Z, which led to these migodi being overrun by illegal immigrants.
You know, in a way, I would like to see this go to court. I think if it does go to court, there are things, so there are laws in place in how you rehabilitate a mine and all of those things. But I think if this goes all the way up, as we are thinking, and I mean, I'm not sure whether human rights lawyers are going to go there or not. I don't know. It will help us with precedence on how government is forced to make sure that companies that come and strip our land do right by us.
Yes.
So that we don't find ourselves
in this position.
Yeah. I think that will be a precedence of some sort.
I'm
hoping it goes all the way up, because we find ourselves here and this is not the only mine.
No.
Yeah.
It's just that this one is making headlines.
Yeah.
But it's happening everywhere.
It's happening everywhere.
Yeah.
So that's, I hope it goes to court, just so that we all find ourselves being responsible for the assets, being responsible for how we are managing our land and all of that. And I think it's going to be an interesting case. Of course, also dealing with the criminals that are harboring other people and doing all sorts of things there. I mean, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
Okay, Ntabiseng, please tell people where to find you.
So we can be found at 272 Oak Avenue in Ferndale, Randburg. We're on the ground floor, office number G2. Otherwise, you can call us on 087-265-8010 or send us a WhatsApp on 079-654-7523. Alternatively, send us an email on info@dubazana10east.co.za.
All right, it's 10 o'clock, folks. I'll be back tomorrow at 8.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.